always we've been having this audio dropouts, which caused the lecture to stop and everything shut down in the middle of the broadcast. And so I decided I'm going to fix that. And because of that, I was having an impossible time to do anything. And because of that, all this struggle took place. This whole event which took place is right within the theme of what I wanted to speak about today. And that theme is, why do anything? I have been thinking about and having to deal with in my own life the question of motivation. Why do things? What is the reason for action? Now, as far as I'm concerned, I would be very happy sometimes being very peaceful and not having so much to do and so on. And peacefulness and relaxation and meditative thoughts and everything, they're very good. They make one feel very comfortable with life. The theme that I wanted to talk about today is related to motivation. So as I was starting to say, this difficulty, this technical difficulty, which I have experienced in trying to make your listening experience, your viewing experience better, is part, very much intimately part of this theme. Now, normally it would be much easier for me to simply let everything be the way it was and, you know, deal with these little glitches. They're uncomfortable, but they're livable. You can live with them. But I was thinking, why should you have to suffer through these technical difficulties and problems? Why can't I go out of my way to make the experience for you better? So I did this work. This is an example of being motivated to do something you would not ordinarily do. Now, I find in my life, I'm much more motivated when there's a desire on the part of others. Now, I saw when I was doing any kind of music, whenever I was engaged in some kind of live music performance, that the audience was just as important as I was, or the members of the group were, in the quality of the performance. I remember once I had an experience when I was in college. We had a band which was quite good, and we had a very avant-garde following. It was a very interesting group. We did the latest kind of music at the time. And when we did one show, I had my first very intense taste of what it was like to have a very focused and enthusiastic audience. I remember how that show started. I just was facing towards the members of the band with my back to the audience. I was singing at that time. And then I just turned around and hit a chord and started. And everybody just started at the same time. And we had just captured the attention of the audience instantly. And that audience was very focused on the music, focused on whatever we did, and appreciative of it. And that inspired us so much that at one point we just went away. We departed from the stock songs that we had in our repertoire. We started writing songs right there on the spot. We were so interactively absorbed with the audience that we just started to get into some grooves, and I just started singing words and melodies that I was making up right on the spot, and the audience loved it. And those who knew the group, knew what we could play, knew what we were supposed to play, were very surprised. They said, "Where did you get all that from?" And I said, "I made it up on the spot." Now, it was only because of the audience that we could do that, because if we were to do that in front of an audience which was skeptical, we would have collapsed within the first three bars. It would have not been possible. It would have been an instantaneous disaster. But it wasn't a disaster because the audience was bringing the best out of us. The audience was saying, yes, yes, you are good. We approve. We want this. We want more of this. Do more. Yes, go. And I would look around at the other members of the band, and everyone had these huge smiles on their faces because they knew what we were doing was impossible. It's impossible to just make up these songs like this and even make changes like this, which made sense. And there were many other examples of that, which I was discovering more and more in my life. There were many other occasions where a very motivated audience was making me do things which ordinarily I could not do. I remember also reading in the newspaper at the time that one time a piano, a very heavy piano, fell on a child. And the mother was so motivated to get that child from out underneath that piano that her adrenaline was just pouring through her with such power that she just moved the piano herself. And that ordinarily took 4 to 6 men, strong men, to do. Now, she was incredibly motivated out of love, which created this intense fear that something was happening to her child. So a superhuman thing, which could not be done under ordinary circumstances, she did. Now, that is a wonderful example of motivation. Now, I've seen this pattern duplicate itself over and over again. When one is very motivated, one can do anything. And I have seen that this motivation is basically the foundation of the energy of life. Now, we have seen in the medical fields that a patient who has an intense will to live can conquer over life-threatening diseases to a far greater degree than those patients who don't have a will to live. When they don't have a will to live, they easily die from their diseases, where those with a will to live are very resistant, much more resistant to death. Just look at the example of Christopher Reeves, the movie star who had played in Superman and a few other movies. He became paralyzed, and he died some time ago. His wife has just died recently. She couldn't live without her husband. She lost her reason to live. She lost that which was the most important part of her life, her connection with her husband. Now, you know, economists have examined this phenomena historically. Why do men work? Now, if men don't have to work, they don't. They can be very lazy, especially in the Playboy variety of men. If they have money, they don't mind spending all their money and wine, women, and song, as they used to say. That's just the nature of men. We're just a bunch of lazy bums by nature. And so economists have shown that the most important thing in the functioning of a society is that this marriage and family, because it motivates men to work, whereas ordinarily they wouldn't be so motivated to do so. The proportion of homeless men to homeless women is very much more weighted towards the homeless men. I know here in Gainesville, you look around and you see the homeless wandering here and there. I mean, maybe I've seen 2 homeless women to every 40, 50 homeless men. Women are much more inclined towards having a security in the home, having a security in the life, a predictable stability than men. So men are motivated when they have somebody to protect, they have some family to maintain, they have some project to do. They're motivated by this creation. Last year, or 2 years ago, we saw this absolutely fabulous play called called In Defense of the Caveman. It was probably the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. Not in television, it was in the Phillips Center. It was a live play, a one-man show. And this theme was all about how the archetypical male of the caveman days and the archetypical female of the caveman days still exists today. And the way in which this person described this is hysterical, but it's very true. Like, for example, this is just one of the many thousands of examples. The caveman, his job is to hunt and kill and bring back the kill to the house so that the family have something to eat and to go out and defend and to secure the borders of the place. This is the man's role, the defender, the killer, the hunter. And the woman was the gatherer, the nurturer, the one who took care of the cave. She organized the cave and gathered the wood for the fire and gathered the herbs and kept everything nicely around. And although these archetypes have to a large extent been modified on all levels, you can still see it. For example, at night, every night before we go to sleep, I go around and check every door. Is it locked? And my main business is to understand, does it work? Is it practical? Whereas my wife, she goes around and says, does it look nice? Does it feel good? Is it very comfortable and soothing? So our dispute can be, whereas I say, it is practical, it works, we shall do this. She says, it doesn't look good, it doesn't fit here, it stinks, get it out. So you can see there are these archetypes, there are these ways in which we are motivated to act. These things are also built into our DNA, built into our cells. So at our fundamental level, as historical, as the fruit of history, as our bodies as being the fruit of evolution, we have certain ways in which we have developed which we cannot deny. For example, if the foundation of a building in the city is a square, you may knock down everything all around it, rebuild it 1,000 ways, remodel it any way you want, but the foundation upon which it rests will dictate to a very large extent what that building will be. It will be in that square form. Whereas another form of foundation will dictate another shape. These fundamental principles have an effect which we have to be aware of, even if it's on a very subtle level. And understanding the basic differences between men and women, or between children and adults, or between young people and old people, or between people of different cultures and times is very important. Because all of these differences are what goes into the creation and the foundation of our motivation in life, that which gives us our raison d'être, the reason for existence, reason of being. We have to have some reason. We have to have some fundamental purpose for our existence. Otherwise, we spin off in some existential crisis, which ultimately can cause our destruction. Some people can be so disappointed, so frustrated, so depressed with their lives, they see absolutely no reason to live, and therefore they, some way or another, end their lives. There are people who commit suicide in a very gross way. They put a gun to their head or whatever. There are people who commit suicide in a very subtle way. They smoke themselves to death. They drink themselves to death. They take drugs themselves to death. There are others who are so absorbed in the contemplation of death, of the inevitability of death, or the, shall we say, desirability of death, that they act in ways which are very careless because They've got nothing to lose. Could you ever figure out why somebody would put some big rubber band around their legs and jump headfirst off of an incredibly high tower straight down to the ground with incredible speed? Well, of course, there are many reasons why one would do that. Maybe because it's very exhilarating, maybe because it's something one would never imagine doing, or maybe because it's a way to flirt with one's own death, or driving insanely fast, or doing things which are just so dangerous, yet are so exhilarating because of the danger. I suppose studies have already been done on this, research has already been done on this, but I would be very interested to understand the underlying subliminal motivation that drives a person to do something which has a very great possibility of killing them. But in any case, this whole question of what motivates us, what makes us do what we do, is fascinating, because when we're not motivated, we really see the drastic difference between a motivated state and a not motivated state. Because when you're in a motivated state and you're just zooming all around doing all kinds of stuff with great enthusiasm, you consider it to be normal. You don't stand back and say, "Hey, why am I motivated? Hey, why am I running around having fun?" You just say, "Hey, this is great." When you're in your normal state, you have energy, you have enthusiasm, you have a reason, you feel good about life. This is the normal state. I know it sounds strange, but that is the normal state. I'll tell you a story which I find to be very relevant to this. In Vrindavan, there was this guy, Johnny Apilawala, I think his category was. I forgot his name now, but he was a very nice man. He had this mystic capacity to take out yellow from you, which is what the Hindi of that roughly translated to, the one who takes out the yellow. Or maybe it was Janapiliawala. His name was Shamashaki, I remember now. Really wonderful fellow. I remember the first time I went to him, I thought, this can't be real. And then when I watched what he did, I said, gee, that is amazing. He took a little water, poured it over your head and body, and then with some plain, I think it was mango bark, he just rubbed. And as he was rubbing in the water, he was murmuring some mantras, and this yellow liquid started pouring out. Now, the water was not yellow, but the bark also not yellow. And when I tried it myself with water in the same bark, it didn't make yellow. So it wasn't yellow bark. It wasn't yellow water. But when he did this, he made this yellow pour out of you. Now, the amazing thing of that, besides the fact that how did he get this yellow to come out of you, was that when you went away, you felt fine. You didn't really consider it. You didn't think about it. You just went about your ways and went about you doing what you were doing quite normally. Now, when I went to him, you know, tired with the eyes like this and just exhausted and just, yeah, right, okay. No real motivation, no feeling to do anything. And then when he did that, you walked away just doing everything naturally and normally, and you didn't think twice about it because that's the normal state. Now, the amazing thing that I discovered was that at one point I just said, well, wait a minute. Before I went to him, I was sick and had no energy to do anything. And now I'm doing everything as if I had no problem. It worked. And yet, somehow, I just couldn't get it into my head that some like miracle had happened because I felt normal. And I was just amazed at the mentality of that. When you're normal, you just think it's all fine. It's only when you're abnormal, when you haven't the energy, when you haven't the enthusiasm, when you haven't the motivation, that you realize there's something wrong and you maybe have to do something about it. So how do you feel? Do you feel enthused? Do you feel full of energy? Do you feel motivated? Are you going through your life as if it was a romp through an evolutionary opportunity? Do you feel like that, or do you feel like, what's the use of this? And why do I have to get up in the morning and the same job and the same work? And, you know, and I'm just sick and tired and I don't want to go on. I can't stand it in any way. Give me another beer. Do you run around looking for opportunities to do something which might inspire you? Some kind of activity which might inspire you? Are you looking for this by other kinds of means which are external to you? If the answer is yes, then you have a problem with the motivation, because it is not in its natural state of enthusiasm for life itself. Now, let's divide this problem into long-term motivation and short-term motivation, because all of us, if I say you or I say me, everything I say actually is equally applicable to all of us. All of us have to deal with these problems on a day-by-day basis. And this, what we have to deal with, is the day-by-day dealing with all of those factors which go into what makes up of our lives. We have to have a long-term reason for existence and a day-by-day reason for existence. Now let's use this structure that I just kind of created, this long-term, short-term motivation with the foundations of the cells and the mentality and the archetypes and so on, to analyze how we deal with our spirituality. Now, all of us, however spiritual we may be, cannot simply dismiss all of these factors within this structure. We cannot just say out of hand, I'm spiritual, none of these factors affect me, I am transcendental. Because we are working with, working in cooperation with our physical vehicles, the environment within which these physical vehicles interact, our family, our societies, our communities, the energy of the universe, all of this is part of our day-to-day existence. Whether you are a spiritualist or not, when you wake up in the morning, you have to have a motivating factor even to get out of bed. There has to be a motivation to take the first steps in the day, to continue throughout the day. There has to be some reason for all of this. Now, often we don't consider it as important. We don't consider it as significantly as we should. We don't consider that these factors are to be respected. So we look outwardly towards the long-term motivation in our lives. We look towards the goal, for instance, to go back to, you fill in the blank, Godhead, heaven, that better place, the other side, the light, however you want to call it. You feel that, we feel, we have this motivation sometimes to go towards that goal. That is our overriding motivation in spirituality. Now, in and of itself, this long-term vision is neither good or bad in and of itself. I think it's fine to have such a vision. I mean, naturally, of course, you want to go to a better place. I'm just speaking it from the structural point of view. It's what we wish it to be that really counts when it comes to motivation. If we believe in it, we're motivated. If we don't, we're not. But the difficulties that sometimes spiritualists face, more often than they'd like to admit, is the little steps to get to that spot. And therefore, that has been dealt with in many philosophies differently. Some people live their lives in a very paranoid state, constantly in fear of doing anything wrong, because everything is written down. Every little thing is written down, and it's all calculated and tallied at the moment of death. And then there's this ding total comes up, and you are given the whatever it is that you're going to attain. And this long-term motivation rules the short-term motivation of every moment. Then there are others who aren't really concerned about all these little details and who have this firm belief that there is just mercy. There will be mercy. Mercy will come to me, and whatever it is, I will be saved at the time of death and attain everything I wish to attain. Now, we are talking about spiritualists here. We're not talking about just everybody. We're talking about spiritualists. And spiritualists see things differently than not the others who are not spiritually inclined. Now, I'm not saying that that makes spiritualists essentially better, because there are plenty of very good people who make every moment a decision, a conscious decision to do something good, to do something right. And there are spiritualists who are so absorbed in their religiosity, they would kill others in the name of their religion. So this is not a value judgment when I say that spiritualists see things differently. But if a spiritualist simply motivates the life based on the long-term goals, one has a very strong possibility of missing out on the second-by-second, moment-by-moment way in which we go through life, which actually builds up to the long-term goal. So therefore, when I said it in the beginning, I said we have to have a long-term vision and a short-term vision which motivates us right now. Without a long-term vision, life seems to be directionless. Without a short-term vision, life seems to be so directed as if it's just a little tiny point long in the future. You could get confused sometimes when one has these problems of directionless, without actually understanding where you're going, or to be so focused on where you're going, you forget about how you're getting there. Both of these are extremes on either end of the spectrum of motivation. Now, obviously, you already know where this is going. We have to create a balance between long-term vision and short-term vision to have our motivating factors be always relevant to us, to always be vibrant and alive in our life. Fine, that's easy to say, it's easy to understand, but when the practical reality of that has to be implemented, we all run into difficulty. Why do anything? When I'm walking through the house at night with my spear in my hand, seeking out any way in which the intruders can come upon the cave, I am working from the platform of cellular motivation. It's in my historical DNA. And when I'm living my life trying not to die, I am living according to a cellular need, a biological need to continue my existence. And when I'm phenomenally hungry and running around trying to find something to stuff in my mouth, I'm dealing with an immediate urge of the belly to get something to eat. Well, so far, none of this is very glorious. None of this is very motivating. None of this is long-term satisfying to my psyche. This is just dealing with things which I have to deal with. It's not like my choice to do it. These are the have-tos of life. My life is based into the have-tos, the want-tos, and the can-dos. But none of these things work so well with spirituality. Have to? I have to do that? Well, have to. Why have to? Otherwise I go to hell? That's not very motivational. That's like avoiding pain. Have to do these things because otherwise this is all negative. And want-tos, this is my wish list. My desires. But that also doesn't help. These are just desires, wishes. These are just like, I wish I could. Fantasies. Well, then there's this other category, can-dos. I can do that. I could do that. I mean, I can. If I could, I can. I mean, I could do that. There's where the potential for opportunity lies for doing something which I might like to do. I can meditate. Why? Well, I like it. Okay, that sounds good to me. I can sing or dance. I can give a talk over the internet. I can maybe play some music if somebody was interested in it. Yeah, that sounds good. I like that. That motivates me. My motivation is these things, depending on the time, make me inspired. I like to do it. There's a reason to do it. So there are these things which are in the can-do category, of which there is a subcategory called I like to do it, and of which there is a category called I like to do it and it's good for me, and then there's a category called I like to do it, it's good for me, and it's great for my evolution. And yet, there's another factor coming into this, which is appropriate action, appropriate motivation according to the circumstances. Is this something which fits according to the time and the place, the circumstances, the situation I'm in? Because if not, I'd better be aware of these things. I like to meditate. Okay, now let's say I'm walking on the street and there's a car accident in front of me and everything is all a big mess and a mash and people are screaming and there's all kinds of chaos around me. So I say, I think I'll meditate. And I sit down there in the middle of the street and I go into a meditative trance. So this is an inappropriate action. Even though that action was good for me, good for my evolution, I like to do it, it was just the wrong thing at the wrong time, the wrong place. Now, if you go through the various rules, regulations, suggestions, guidelines, and disciplines that are involved in spirituality, you will find many times there are things being asked of us which are not appropriate for us. The inappropriateness does not mean there is something wrong about these suggestions or guidelines or laws or whatever, or there's something not beneficial about them or any negativity about them. It merely says that the way in which it is applied to us may or may not be valid at any moment in time. Let's say you're not one of Jas Muhin's light-eating group, and you are a regular person who's living on food. Now, in various spiritual disciplines, fasting is a factor. That in certain days you should fast, or in certain ways you should fast. This is kind of given as a principle. On these days you fast. And we fast, we try to fast. Yet some people have really lousy bodies, or shall we say reactions to this fasting. It's not favorable for them. I'm one of them. On the day of the fast, instead of doing all kinds of nice spiritual things and not being involved in work, basically, I can't do very much. My head is pounding with pain or some other kind of problem. This was in the past, would be there. And I would have a basically miserable time. So therefore, one has to balance between all of these things and know when to put them in the right place, in the right situation. In other words, you have to guide your own life for that long-term vision of your evolution and the short-term vision of your evolution, the moment-by-moment understanding, that which motivates you. You know, sometimes we spend so much time worrying about how to live our lives and trying to figure out what to do in life that life just happens to us rather on a moment-by-moment basis rather than we are living in a moment-by-moment basis. You know, if life is something that happens to you while you're busy doing things, you may not be in the best situation because life is an interactive event where that excitement from motivation rules it rather than life's actions are ruling us. I would think that a person who's motivated to live right now in the present in the best possible way they can, would by definition, be easier to deal with, would be much more compatible with those around him or her, would be a person who's very much in balance amongst all of the opposing factors in life, than a person who has some long-term goal and doesn't really pay attention to what they're doing right now. Just imagine this. There's a dark room. You're in the far side of the dark room. Somebody opens a door on the other side. Light comes through, but you can only basically see the light. And you run towards the door because you just got to get to the light. And as you're running to the light, you smash your legs on this and knock over that and break this in your desperate attempt to get to the light. This is what happens when somebody is simply focused on this long-term motivation. They're not aware of what's going on right now, right in front of them, and how that affects their desire to get somewhere and how that affects everybody else around them. It is for this reason that in many religious or spiritual organizations, you will find an enormous amount of personal conflict, an enormous amount of personal politics, group creation and politics. Because in the mad rush to liberation, one doesn't take care for that which is right now around us. Life can be so different if one is aware of the moment, aware of what's around us, aware of the people, aware of the situation, aware of what we are, our defects or our needs or our elemental existence down to the bottom of our cellular structure, the historical DNA, the genetics that we have, our behavior that has been modified by our life. If we're aware of these things, everything can transform. So one can connect to the moment. One can connect to the moment as our motivation. Our motivation for the day-by-day existence can be to live life in the moment with full awareness, because it's only by doing so that we could ever attain the long-term goals or visions if we have them. Yet at the same time, we have to respect our need to have fun. We have to respect our needs to do something which is enlivening to us, which manifests our creative capacities, which manifests that goodness that we are. You know, we have to make decisions on the basis of many factors. We don't just get a job just because it pays good. It has to be something that we can live with, that we feel we can grow with. We can't get married just because the sex is good. There has to be communication. There has to be connection on a person-to-person soul level, even the mind level, emotional levels. We have to live in a house not because it just puts a roof over our head. We have to feel good there. All of these factors are very important because they are the moment-by-moment parts of our life. So when we engage ourselves in our day-to-day life, we should be seeing these experiences that we are having as possibilities, as potential opportunities with potential for enlivening us, for being fun to do, or for being building blocks towards something great, a creation which we are feeling proud of, which we want to be a part of. We have to have a connection, a taste for what we're doing. We have to feel that we are part of something and that our every moment of awareness should be to represent that final destination, that final goal, which is that spiritual goodness that we are. Here's an interesting point. If you want something, give it. Now, people ordinarily would think, if I want something, I should take it. But no, this is quite opposite. If you want it, give it. You want love? Give it to others. You want fun? Give it to others. You want excitement? Give it to others. If you want things in life which are intangibles. These things are not something that you can capture like money. They are things which are attracted by the magnetism of our spirit. So ultimately, why do anything? It boils down to right now, how you wish to be. And that wonderful statement in Conversations with God just pops to mind. Right now, I should be manifesting the next greatest version of the greatest vision I have ever had of myself. In other words, right now, whatever the greatest vision I have had of myself is. Now, that's an interesting point because maybe I have reduced my vision or I have given up hope. But no, if I had a greater vision of myself before, that's the relevant point. And if I create an even greater vision, a grander vision of myself in the future, that will replace the greatest vision and I will be able to expand into it. Don't go backwards. And what does it mean, the next greatest version? It means to evolve towards that vision, to be the best you can possibly be by always upgrading your operating system within you to the next greatest version of it, towards that absolute goal that you have established for yourself, that grand vision of yourself. And if you do like that, you'll never have a problem answering the question, why do anything? And you'll be living your dreams, you'll be living your life according to the greatest vision you've ever had of yourself. And you'll just be updating your way of getting there, your way of being that. Not that it's a destination, but it's a way of being, to just upgrade yourself to being more and more of that vision of what you are. And this gives a just an absolutely wonderful reason for existence, an absolutely wonderful reason for being everything you can be. And what could be better than that? So at this point, we'll have a break until 30 minutes after the hour. There'll be some music in the meantime because it's actually all working again. And then if you can send me your questions, if you have any, we can do that. And then after that, we can have a meditation. I have here one question. Is it better to desire to go to God than to desire to be the best one can, and this will help one to go to God? That's an interesting question because sometimes in spirituality there's this idea we have to go to God, that God is somewhere and we have to get there. We have to make ourselves something. We have to go on a journey. We have to develop and then we get there to God. And then when we're there and that's it. Whereas in this other idea that was stated today, we have the possibility of just being the very best we can, yet we have a vision of ourselves, a grand vision, and that grand vision can include our divinity, it can include our connection with the supreme and divine, and thus it is also an idea to go to God, but without having to physically go there, by just manifesting our divinity. I would say to a certain extent it's a semantic problem where when you say go to God, it makes one think it's a process of traveling. You know, it's a step by step to travel to get to some other place. That may not be really what people think inside or feel inside when they say that. Yet at the same time, if you think about your greatest vision of yourself, your grandest vision of yourself, well, if my grand vision is to be connected with the Supreme, to be one with the Supreme in that sense, to be the best I can possibly be in all my fullness, I don't see it being so different. Yet, at the same time, the idea of being the next greatest version towards that vision, does wonderful things. It gives us a feeling of integration with the present, and yet that integration with the present is our steps towards becoming that greatest vision in the future. So it seems to me that this is a superior way to see it, to feel it, to live it. There's another question here, which is interesting and yet presumptuous at the same time, but I'll say it anyway. That question is asking me, what is the motivation of demigods? It's presumptuous in the sense that someone would think I could answer that question, and it's funny because I probably could answer it. Now, if you think about it, let's take, for example, somebody like Indra. You could also take Agni, anyone. Indra has a position, king of the heavens, also dealing with weather, controlling weather. Agni, the deity of fire. These persons have built, so to speak, within them a very specific responsibility or a specific task. Together, connected with their existence and their forms within this universe, are the ways in which they are supposed to be manifesting their energy. Now, Agni deals with fire. Okay, his form is of fire. He exists within that fiery energy. He is his consciousness is there within the fire. So, naturally, his whole existence is intimately connected with fire. And Indra, being in a managerial position, in the role of demigods, the realm of the demigods, his form, his regal form, his regal powers are intimately connected with his function. So that gives us a clearer indication that these personalities' motivation would have to be connected with their functioning. In other words, it's not that Indra can decide on a midlife career change, or the demigod in charge of fire can wake up one morning and saying, this isn't so hot, I think I'd rather deal with water. I'll become now dealing with water. They don't have that capacity. Similarly, Agni doesn't have the capacity to make his residence within water or to make his residence in a vacuum. These specific functions of these personalities, their forms, and their motivations are all linked together. There's a lack of what they can do as compared to we actually could make such changes if we wanted to. Well, that's also not really true because, I mean, if I decided I don't like living here walking on the earth anymore, I'd like to fly on with my wings or fly in the air. I couldn't do that. I'm limited by my form too. So I suppose in that sense we're very similar. Now, those who are of the deva category have great power, have great responsibility, yet they have a great motivation to carry out their responsibility. That's part of their personality characteristic. They are souls who have the motivation to perform these tasks. They don't just become depressed and stop doing it at one point. That seems to be a primary characteristic for being appointed to such a position. You have the internal capacity to do so. You have the integrity within your spirit, and you are motivated to do so. You have at least the potential to be motivated and remain motivated. So what motivates anybody, regardless of their position, is how they see it as fulfilling or nourishing their interests, giving them the experiences that they wish to have in their lives. Now, I'm often asked about this business of experiences, the intensity of experiences, the choices of which experiences we should make. And again, this is based on our motivation. What is it that makes us tick? Why do we do what we do? And what do we think we're going to get at? In other words, what is that vision of ourselves? Now, as far as I'm concerned, I very much believe in and ascribe to and act upon this idea that life is an experience, that these experiences are the integral part of life. And they're very important, they're essential, they're necessary, and they are the fuel by which evolution takes place. And due to my particular nature, I like intense experiences too. But that does not mean I want to, need to, have to engage in all experiences. Experiences as a category of events are good, but it doesn't mean you have to have every experience. You have to go through every experience. You have to search out every experience. It means you can take those experiences that you find advantageous for yourself. Now, you may be wondering why I'm speaking about this and why I'm even bringing this up. Well, this is in direct response to a question, and it's a question which spiritualists have been toying with throughout time about the relationships between men and women and the experiences, the intensity of those experiences. Now, it's not only or exclusively that religions like to control people and that restricting or keeping them from family existence is a very good way to exert power over people. That is not a full picture of renunciation. Naturally, this is part of it, but how much part of it, it depends on each and every case. There are other factors which are also extremely important for individuals to consider. Some individuals have been through a lot of experiences, have been through a lot of relationships, have found that as much as they would like them to work out nicely, they never really do, and what they really want is to expand themselves spiritually, so they have made the decision, at least now, that the next greatest version of themselves will not include a relationship. It will be a program without that entanglement to focus on forward progress. They may say that. After all, if these experiences, if these relationships are the cause of pain, and this pain is an obstacle or a deviation on the path of evolution, removing the sources of pain, relieving oneself from the pain, can be a very positive thing. It can expand one's experience. It can expand one's consciousness. It can give great fuel and energy to development. And so long as one continues to see relevance in what one is doing in this form of detachment, if one continues to see it beneficially, then one will continue to do it. It's the choice one makes in that next greatest version, the minute-by-minute, moment-by-moment decision process we make. That may go on for a long period of time. It may go on for not such a long period of time. But the reason one will not want to have that particular kind of experience is something that we decide when we feel it is in our best interest to decide to do it. Now, I've got another question here which is directly related to this, because that question is that this person is saying since the beginning of their search for spiritual life, they always trusted their own intuitive awareness more than anything else. And that person says that it always worked out for them. It always worked out for the best. But there is a possibility that could be, there could be some pitfalls, there could be some traps, some hidden problems that we're not aware of. Well, I would answer that maybe those problems are hidden because they're supposed to be. Maybe there's a reason for it. Maybe you have decided not to see a certain problem because you need to work in a particular way. Again, when you say my own intuitive awareness, what you are really saying is, you make choices based on your consciousness at the moment the choice has to be made. Now, if somebody is doing that based on their heart, I would consider that a good thing. If somebody was doing that based on what they thought they should do, that they have heard they should do from something external to them, I would say that is a pitfall, because there are problems that can occur. Actually, this is the whole subject of another whole lecture, and I don't want to get into it too much more, because you can go on talking about this for hours. For example, why does a person feel that when they're alone, they don't have any family connection? Is that better for them than if they would have? What really are they looking for? There can be good and bad in any decision one makes. The only way you can really deal with it is to be very clear about why you're doing what you're doing at every moment in time. That's the only criteria, to just be clear about why you're doing what you're doing. If you don't want to be involved in any relationship with the opposite sex, and it's because you've had great pain in such relationships, then be very honest with yourself about it, saying that I haven't had any good luck, therefore I want to stop worrying about it, it's just causing me problem. One could also choose to think that, well, I'll just make myself the best person I can be, I'll just develop myself as much as I can, and if I happen to have or find or some relationship that's very good for me and is compatible with me happens to appear or manifest or I can get involved in it, I will consider it. And then you got the problem, which is a very serious problem, of being not focused or being determined to carry a task through from point A to point Z, from beginning to end. One could be deviated in one's tasks here, there, and everywhere, and never really have a straight thread of development. I'll give you an example. Let's say somebody has this feeling within themselves that, well, I believe in renunciation, ultimately. I believe in detachment. So, okay, I'm in this relationship, and, you know, it's kind of pleasant now. But when it becomes tough, when it becomes difficult, then I understand that actually it's all just illusion and I should get out of it. But that's not necessarily the best way to think about it, because it could be, and it usually is, I didn't want to say it is, but you get the point, that the lesson of the experience is to learn compromise, is to learn how to adapt yourselves to others in this world, is to learn how to go from the dark side of the room to the light at the door with the lights on. So you walk around obstacles, not that you're smashing yourself on the way to the light. Now one has to make those decisions. One has to be motivated long term along with the short term. But that long term has to be there. In other words, are you in it for a longer period of time? Can I trust that you have a commitment to this line of activity that I can depend on for some longer period of time? Are you a dependable person? Or are you the kind of person who gives up when things get difficult? Or are you the kind of person who doesn't want to invest work, effort, even to have to face pain, agony, or any of the difficulties of life to maintain that commitment? Yet at the extreme, that same mentality says, never change, never deviate, always continue the way you have set forth, no matter what, even if it kills you and everyone around you. So obviously the middle of this is to have a long-term commitment to some way of action, to work towards that, to invest in that, to take the trouble and the pain and the effort to make that happen. But when you have to, when you see the need, when it's obvious that changing is a good thing, then don't be afraid to do it. Have some faith in that. So I would say this continuously looking to the to the long term, back to the short term of our motivation, of what makes us feel life is worth living for. This continuous vision, in other words, seeing it overall, being able to see the forest and the trees. This is the gift of awareness. And within that vision, you will sometimes do something you don't want to do, but you know you have to do because it's part of the package. And you'll do sometimes things you want to do and you love to do. You will find that there's good and bad in everything. You will be able to deal with that good and bad for the sake of your long-term motivational factors, your long-term motivational values. And at the same time, you'll be able to deal with the present moment and guide yourself towards the best possible forms of action without lamenting at every moment. And I think that this way of seeing things would answer an enormous amount of questions. And I think this is a good time to start to talk about the meditation that we can do today. I wanted to do a meditation which would embody everything we've talked about today. Yet I realized that what we've really been talking about is that forest and the trees. This whole concept of getting the complete picture of our lives. When you say the next greatest version of the grandest vision we've ever had of ourselves, that means the grandest version, the grandest vision is the forest. The next greatest version is the way we see the trees in the forest. We may have a vision of a great forest, but if it's not there yet, we have to have a plan by which the trees may be placed there. Yet we have to constantly be aware of the need to make adjustments, modifications in the plan, to adjust the plan to the new circumstances that are always evolving, coming upon us. So I felt that the meditation that we should do would be to visualize that grand vision of ourselves. Yet we may have had a grander vision in the past. Now, sometimes we've had a vision of ourselves in the past, which may have been grander in scope, but may have had no relationship to ourselves. Because don't forget, it's the grandest vision of ourselves. That vision may be disconnected from ourselves. It may just be a vision, somebody else's vision. So I thought the meditation would be very interesting. If we were to meditate on our present grandest vision of ourselves, and then consider what we had in the past as a grand vision of ourselves, which we now think in perhaps illusion, is a better way of thinking. We may feel that this present vision we have is some kind of modification, it's some kind of reduction of our standards. So I want us to examine that previous concept, which we feel we have lost because we're not worthy or not good enough or whatever, and see if it was actually connected to ourselves or if it was connected to some illusion. And then to accept whatever it is that is our grandest vision, to accept it, to embrace it, and then to be aware of what that, how we are now, what is our present version of ourselves. And keeping in view our grandest vision and understanding our present version, understand what would be the best way to manifest the next version in the next moment, which we're going to create right now, if you understand my meaning. And to, in this meditation, moment by moment, keep building that version, keep upgrading our version. And to see how far we can go in this meditation. So I hope this is something that you will like, that you will have a good experience with, and that you can reproduce whenever you feel like doing it.